Welcome back to another episode of More From Sam, where we get more from Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I have to start the show off by telling the audience about the new shows we've just announced for next year. But first, I have a quick reminder that we have some tickets still available for Chicago on November 19th. So if anybody wants to come out to that, come see us. But for 2026, here are the shows we have not announced yet. I mean, we have via newsletter and maybe some socials, but have not done it on the show yet. January 21st, 2026 in Los Angeles, February 4th in Dallas, February 5th in Austin, March 11th in Portland, March 12th in Vancouver, April 23rd in Palm Beach, Florida, May 12th in Toronto, May 13th in Washington, D.C., and finishing off the tour with New York City on May 14th. So hopefully we'll see lots of people out there next year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. As you know, I'm continuing to evolve the talk, so it's kind of fun to... I've never done it like this, where I've got a tour that's stretched out that far in the future. So I just know the talk is going to keep changing from event to event. So, yeah.
Okay, on to our first topic. I did not know this, or at least I didn't remember it, but you used to have a fear of public speaking, and now you're on tour and seem very comfortable on stage. Can you talk about your journey from stage fright to where you are now?
Well, so yeah, there was that blog post that got resurfaced, I think, on Reddit that I'd kind of forgotten about. I think I wrote it 12 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. And I think the title is The Silent Crowd. I think that's what it is on my blog. Maybe I should repost it on Substack because people found it useful, I think. Well, obviously, it's a very common fear. And I just had, you know, in this blog post, I give some people fairly concrete advice about how to deal with it. Ironically, I mean, though I think mindfulness is actually quite helpful, I don't think it's sufficient to deal with it for most people. I think it's this. The crucial bit is to actually just do the thing you're afraid of and get used to it and cease to catastrophize about it and to have some better or even just benign outcomes after doing it, right? You know, to give a talk and to have it not be a catastrophe and then to let your nervous system learn across those occasions. I think that's better than simply hoping that you're going to meditate or do talk therapy or anything else in the absence of just doing more of that thing you're afraid of. So something like cognitive behavioral therapy is probably still the gold standard for this, where you have strategies for reframing the experience itself and approaching the experience itself. And yeah, no, it was something that I always was very anxious about. I mean, it wasn't a huge variable in my life, but I was avoiding it. You know, as a student, I was avoiding it. I was the valedictorian of my high school, and as the valedictorian, you have to give a talk at graduation. And so I declined the honor of being a valedictorian. I just said, no, I'm not doing that. And there were several instances like that where I just passed up the opportunity to speak because I didn't want to have to pass through this wall of anxiety on the way to the event. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school, which was a good long while because I went to graduate school late. So I was in my early 30s. I realized I had to get over this. And especially with the release of my first book, I had to get over it, right? There's just no way to be a successful author, except for the extreme case of just becoming a man of mystery somehow that people who still want to read, you know, somebody like J.D. Salinger or Trevanian or Thomas Pynchon. But most authors need to get out there in front of crowds and talk about the fact that they just wrote a book, and most publishers would demand that of them. So I knew that was coming with my first book, and so I just had to get behind myself and push and very quickly got over it. And I had some very high stakes appearances out of the gate. I mean, like I still haven't done that much public speaking. I mean, you know, this is the first tour I've done in like 6 years, as you know, but you know, in my first couple events, so I was very quickly, I was in situations where it was going to be like a televised debate, you know, so the stakes kind of ramped up pretty quickly, but in the end it was fine. And now, as you know, I simply complain about the fact that the auditorium isn't full. my concern is that I just get more people in the seats. So things have flipped nicely, but it's there are not that many tangible experiences of self-overcoming where the thing you are most avoidant of is the thing that you actually sort of like doing now. I mean, to be able to flip one of those is notable and psychologically empowering. And this is one that's pretty easy to do. And anyway, in that blog post, I get into some more concrete recommendations for people.
And is it gone now? Does it ever, you know, come back? Any sort of pre-show jitters?
I think I have like physiological arousal that is sort of akin to anxiety before an event, but it's, I just perceive it as energy now. I mean, this is kind of a reframing of anxiety that is available to anyone. You can notice that anxiety is fairly indistinguishable physiologically from excitement, and apart from your thoughts about it, about what you, the thoughts you're using to frame it, and you can just kind of grab the reins of your mind and reframe it. You can just decide to think about the fact that you actually just care to how this event goes. You want to do a good job. You know, in this case, people paid for tickets. They took a night out of their lives to come and see me. I care that they have a good time or find it valuable. So if I feel any energy, you know, any energy that's like anxiety, it really feels that I actually just care, you know, and that I have a stake in this. But no, it's the experience has been flipped for me. It's pretty nice to have flipped it that way.
I used to, before I'd go on stage, I would imagine that I had just gotten off stage and was very disappointed in my performance. And now I get a chance to go back up there. And how would I do that now?
That's a nice reframing. Yeah, that's that could apply to many situations.
Yeah,
right.
Well,
whatever
it was, now I'm a manager, so it didn't work out. too well for me. All right. I saw that there's a movie on Netflix directed by Catherine Bigelow and written by Noah Oppenheim. And I mentioned the writer here specifically because he has credited the Making Sense podcast with the title of the film. So, of course, I had to watch it and scared the shit out of me. How about you?
Oh, I thought it was very effective. It was the world's most effective PSA, right? It's just it's a film, you know, with great actors, but it really plays like a PSA because it is just exposing how morally insane and psychologically implausible our nuclear status quo is, right? I mean, it just, for people who haven't seen it, I'm not giving anything away, it depicts an America that is now on the receiving end of a single missile, incoming missile, presumed to be a nuclear first strike, the source of which can't be identified because I think the satellite that would track that was jammed. And now we've got, 20 minutes to decide whether to return fire. And so our doctrine is to launch if there's, you know, if incoming missile, especially in the case where you have more than one incoming missile and there's this prospect of having our launch capacity destroyed by a first strike. If we see a bunch of missiles coming our way, the doctrine suggests that there's some version of our retaliating before anything has landed, before we know absolutely for certain that this isn't some kind of radar error, et cetera. So, but when you actually look at how this unfolds psychologically and socially among all the participants, and this is not the first document to depict this, but in film form, this is the only one I know that's done it this effectively and has shown all these beats. It's completely insane, right? I mean, this is something that you can read about this at greater length in Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, which shows our whole continuity of government plan and how we've trained for it. And there are these scenes in that book that, and there's similar moments in this film, that show just how impractical and in some sense morally unconscionable the expected behavior is. So the drilled behavior is, you know, certain key people need to be spirited away before the missiles hit. They need to be taken to some underground lair where they can ensure the continuity of government and, you know, in Dr. Strangelove style, repopulate the earth. And so one of these drills, like an army helicopter lands on the soccer field to grab, I think it was the Secretary of State or someone like that, who's at his daughter's soccer game. And he's expected to leave at that moment without his family to go underground, you know, to continue the American project in the face of a presumed nuclear attack. And he's like, well, what are you kidding? I'm not getting on that helicopter, right? And he's like, I'm not leaving my family here to die, right? And he knew it was a drill, but it was just like, this is the plan and it's insane, right? And what's especially insane is the doctrine that has to be, that falls under the judgment of one person, the President of the United States, who has to decide with the clock ticking in mere minutes, in some cases like 6 minutes, whether or not to annihilate tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people as perhaps his last act on Earth, right? And usher in the extreme case, usher in a nuclear winter that more or less destroys everyone, right? I mean, and so who's going to do that? Who's going to think it's sane to do that? How is our deterrence against our enemies predicated on their assumption that our president will do that? The whole thing is bonkers. And anyway, the film gives you a glimpse of how bonkers it is.
Yeah, the film is really well done, and I encourage everyone to go check it out because it really is, as you said, a great PSA. But I just wanted to stay here for a second on, you've talked about this before. I mean, you know, the mutually assured destruction, mad concept does seem insane. I mean, you know, if the president, whoever he or she is at that time, fires back, you know, you said they'll go down as, you know, potentially the one of the greatest killers of humankind in history.
Yeah. Well, not even potentially. I mean, just emphatically so, in addition to the, whoever sent the incoming missiles in the first place. Yeah.
Right. And so if they don't do anything and we lose 200 million Americans, but yet they spare the rest of the world, perhaps that's the better position.
Yeah, I just don't see how the expectation of retaliation is at all credible or plausible. I think it's important. I mean, mutually assured destruction is predicated on the bluff and the acceptance of that bluff that we will respond. But I don't think it is compatible with anyone's sanity to think that we really will respond. I mean, I think it's morally insane to think that, okay, we're going to all die here. Basically, we're going to be reduced to, you know, radioactive ruins, and, you know, whoever's left alive is going to be like the people on the, you know, the perimeter of Hiroshima or Nagasaki moments after the blast. Because now, I mean, this is not what House of Dynamite depicts, but again, that was just a single missile. But in the true nuclear first strike concern against, you know, with Russia or now China, it really is a picture of, okay, we've got all these ICBMs incoming. There's nothing we're going to be able to do to stop them until we get some magical Golden Dome technology, which presumably we're now working on. But even there are reasons to believe that that's not something we're going to be able to rely on. But in the current case, we know we can't knock these missiles down. And if hundreds are coming in and they're all aimed at major cities and population centers, we're all going to die. So what exactly is achieved by now killing hundreds of millions of people on the other side of the world? Well, exactly nothing. And the only thing that could have been achieved was the credible threat of doing that would have stopped the incoming missiles in the first place. But that hasn't happened, right? For whatever reason, our deterrence has failed, and now the missiles are incoming. I honestly don't see anyone in that position deciding to kill hundreds of millions of people. It just seems it doesn't serve any purpose at that moment. The purpose that was served was the bluff that was called, and now the bluff was no longer operative.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And related to that, it seems that Trump wants to resume nuclear testing because apparently Russia is doing it. And I guess, well, we have to as well. I think that's almost a direct quote.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I mean, I don't know what testing actually means. If we're talking about, you know, above ground tests where you see the gigantic mushroom cloud.
No, I think it's
cloud.
Below ground, I think they're wanting to do.
Right. Well, so I mean, maybe there's ways of testing parts of weapons. I mean, clearly we can't have an arsenal that is decades old and we don't know whether or not it works, right? So there's got to be some way of maintaining our credible deterrence. Again, the rumors about the status of our technology are fairly alarming, right? I mean, the kinds of computers that are governing the launch of ICBMs, et cetera. I mean, this is not modern equipment, as far as I know. And so—
All on floppy disks?
I mean, I guess there's an irony that it's probably less hackable as a result of being so antiquated too. So there may be a layer of safety built into its obsolescence as well. But I mean, still, it's just the idea that we can just sit on all this tech year after year and not reinvest in it doesn't seem tenable to me. But clearly, the world has to figure out how to walk back from this particular brink and denuclearize. I mean, I don't see how the end game is for us to just keep this world rigged to explode the way it is. I mean, the thing that's so scary, you know, above and beyond the malicious use of these weapons, the thing that's truly terrifying is the possibility of an inadvertent use of these weapons or a launch based on misinformation or, you know, cyber attack. Or, I mean, there have been so many accidents and near accidents, and it's just, we're continuing to roll these invisible dice, and eventually, if we roll them enough, they're going to come up to our peril. Yeah, so I think it's worth continually to revisit this topic. I mean, that's what's so valuable about this film is that it's gotten people talking about nuclear weapons. We have a generation of people that have more or less forgotten that this was a thing. One review of this movie was completely insane, that it seemed to suggest it was kind of an anti-American, you know, libtard document that just was made it seem like the nuclear status quo was somehow a bad thing. Well, it is quite obviously a bad thing, right? I mean, it's just the idea that we're in some ideal circumstance here, where having brought the world to this capacity of mutual annihilation, it's bonkers. I mean, the only argument in its favor is that a world of true mutually assured destruction with only two superpowers, which we've, you know, that's a world we're now quickly losing, that deterrence, nuclear deterrence, or the specter of a conventional war escalating into a nuclear one, may have mitigated the risk of conventional war between superpowers. And that may be, in fact, be true. I mean, maybe we would have fought a war with Russia in the absence of nuclear weapons already. But I mean, we're just seeing the unraveling of the status quo and the urge toward proliferation. I mean, the game theory of all of this just looks awful.
What are your thoughts about the likes of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Charles Murray, and other people right of center suddenly finding Jesus after considering themselves atheists or secular and moving into Christianity while claiming it as the bedrock of Western values?
Well, I've avoided commenting on this specifically in many contexts.
And I think your Substack fans know this, which is why they've asked this again and again.
Well, I mean, so first, I never want to say anything about Ayaan that is derogatory. I mean, Ayaan is just a straight up hero to me, and she should be to women everywhere. I mean, that's just the ground truth of where I think she should sit in people's minds. But she's not perfect, right? And I don't think her defense of her conversion to Christianity makes much sense. Certainly, she didn't give any reasons why she now believes that Christian doctrine is true, right? I mean, what you have in the case of many people is the argument that we as a society need an attachment to Christianity or some other faith to resist the slide into Islamic theocracy on the one hand, or just a secular wasteland of meaninglessness and porn addiction and distraction and, you know, social media poisoning on the other, right? So it's, how do you have a good life in the modern world and resist the barbarians at the gate? The barbarians here being the Islamist hordes that are invading Western Europe, and Ayaan is especially in touch with that problem. Many people think you need, you know, good Christian soldiers to do this on some level. I reject that idea. I think it's almost certainly not true. But even if it were true, it wouldn't give you any reason to believe that Jesus was born of a virgin or rose from the dead or be coming back to judge the living and the dead, and et cetera. So it just simply does not provide a reason to believe anything that Christians must believe in order to be Christians. So that's the problem that Ayaan and Douglas Murray and anyone else who would tend to make these kinds of noises, that there's a social and civilizational importance for doubling down on Christianity as a kind of bulwark against this civilizational unraveling on the one hand and or civilizational clash with Islam on the other. It just doesn't make any sense. It's illogical. It's not accurate. You know, psychologically or spiritually or in any other way. And Charles Murray, I haven't read Charles Murray's book, but I think he's just taking a different angle here. I think he's, you know, he's 80 years old or thereabouts and coming to view his life, I mean, the broad sweep of his life. And I think he is, I've heard him talk about his book a little bit. I think he's just acknowledging that there's a, if not a God-shaped hole, some kind of hole in the middle of his life as he perceives it that could and should be filled by faith. And I think he's taken instruction from his wife, who's religious, and he notices he's always envied her that capacity. Again, and I'm going to talk to Ross Douthat eventually here too. I'm sure we're going to cover this ground because he's written a book on the necessity of belief, which I haven't read yet, but it's on the stack. Anyone who's making these particular claims just strikes me as someone who doesn't know how to meditate on some level. I mean, that's really it really is the problem. If you think that you need to believe something about the divine origin of a book in order to get the juice out of life, there's certain experiences you obviously haven't had. You don't know how to pay attention sufficiently to recognize that your own mind is the circumstance of a real collision with reality that doesn't lack for profundity, right? You don't have to go to the old book to find out what's profound. You don't have to read the story of you know, fictional or otherwise, of someone else's spiritual adventures, and then merely place faith in those so as to redeem an otherwise, you know, fragmented and unsatisfying life circumstance. No, there's actually, you can confront the absolute mystery of being directly with your attention if you can only break the spell of your thoughts and pay attention. And that's what meditation is for. I mean, what one could say in a theistic context, on some level, that's what prayer is for. That's what the, you know, contemplative Christian life is for, or the Jewish one, or the Muslim one. You know, there are disciplines of attention that any contemplative engages that take them out of the superficiality of the rest of their lives. But the problem with the Christian and Jewish and Muslim variants is that all of those disciplines are engaged within a context of belief that is dualistic and propitiatory and just drenched in myth and what I would view as conceptual confusion, right? And the need of believing the preposterous there is so front and center and never really leaves. It's not to say that Christian and Jewish and Muslim contemplatives don't have extraordinary experiences, but insofar as they do, they begin to sound like Buddhists, right? And that's the problem. Like, if you become Meister Eckhart, in the Catholic Church starts to wonder whether or not they should burn you alive, as they were getting ready to do before he died. And so it is in the Muslim tradition. You know, someone like Rumi can only speak so sanely before life becomes dangerous. And the Sufis generally are looked at as heretics anyway, under Islam. So it's just that the contemplative wisdom has not been spread equally over the surface of the earth and given to every culture equally in the same way that, you know, scientific wisdom wasn't 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And yeah, so all these guys need a couple of psychedelic experiences and then real instruction in how to pay attention to the nature of their minds. And they wouldn't be thinking that, you know, the best thing ever written on these matters was in the Bible. I mean, there's no way to think that if you know how to pay attention.
So you don't think we'll ever outgrow religion? So if, you know, AI delivers utopia?
No, I think we will. I mean, I certainly think it has eroded and will continue to erode. There are hundreds of questions upon which religion used to be an authority, but that authority has now been ceded to science or, you know, a secular understanding of what's real. I would say there are no questions that used to be in the province of science and secular rationality that have been ceded back to religion as the authority, right? So it's like, I mean, just to take, you know, an obvious example, it's like the notion of demonic possession to account for epilepsy, right? It's like, we didn't understand neurology at all. We see someone flopping around on the ground. We assume that's demonic possession because that's, you know, we're in a pre-scientific, religiously bamboozled context, and that's how we describe it. But once you get a science of neurology, then you now understand what's happening here. You know, there's some stragglers, there's some people still left thinking, well, maybe that is demonic possession, you know, even if though we now call it epilepsy. But no, actually, we know enough about epilepsy now that's never getting ceded back to religion, right? And there's going to be 1,000 more things like that, where it's just a unidirectional conquest of real estate, where a scientific or secular understanding of what's going on is going to claim the territory and never give it back.
Okay, moving on. We have Doug Wilson coming up on an episode of the podcast. It's going to be coming out soon. Can you just remind everybody who he is and then just quickly set that up for us and let us know how it went?
Yeah, so Doug Wilson is a pastor who was not all that prominent when I first heard of him. He debated my friend Christopher Hitchens in a series of debates, and they actually published a book together that was, I guess, the transcript or the edited transcript of one of their debates, and then they went on tour with it and did a series of debates, and then there was a documentary based on that tour called Collision, which I think is available on YouTube and maybe elsewhere. So I knew of Doug Wilson from maybe 12 or 15 years ago, whenever that happened, and knew that he had debated Hitch, and hadn't really heard anything about him in the intervening years, except recently it was disclosed that he was effectively Pete Hegseth's pastor, or that Hegseth was in one of the churches that is under Wilson's umbrella organization, and that, you know, he's committed to some fairly theocratic positions. So, you know, the head of our Department of Defense is taking instruction from someone who is just willing to live out of Leviticus on some level. And so I wanted to talk to him just to get a sense of his perception of the American religious landscape and just to know what he believes and where he thinks this is all headed and where it should head. And inevitably, we wound up debating a few points, but most of the interview is me just trying to elicit his worldview and to see exactly what he's willing to commit to and therefore to gain some insight into this brand of Christianity that seems to be more politically relevant now than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, that should be a good one. I want to switch subjects for a second. And I want to say this. I get why Jews should care about anti-Semitism, but I want you to explain to us why anyone else should care. Like, you know, they got their own shit to worry about. Why does anti-Semitism impact everybody else?
Well, when you look at what anti-Semites hate, you see that they hate many more things than just Jews, right? I mean, they hate liberalism. They hate the principles that would allow us to maintain an open society, you know, pluralism and equality under the law and meritocracy. And I mean, there are many things that come along for the ride when you start singling out the Jews with your conspiracy theories and your scapegoating and your urge for repression and exclusion. And so it's not just an act of special pleading to say that anti-Semitism is bad. It really is. It's bad for the moral and institutional architecture of any open society, right? I mean, I could say the same thing about racism too, but it's a one sign of the unraveling of a commitment to open, liberal, democratic, tolerant societies.
Next topic. Did you see this video where the Red Cross issued a statement condemning Hamas for staging the recovery of an Israeli hostage body while its own staff were at the scene watching the stunt take place? Any thoughts on
that?
Yeah,
I saw a coverage of it, yeah. Yeah, well, so this is a larger problem where all these NGOs have been, to one or another degree, corrupted by their need to collaborate with Hamas. I mean, there's just no way to operate in Gaza without going through Hamas. So from the UN on down, you find some of these orgs actually just staffed by members of Hamas. I mean, that was true of UNRWA, the UN commission that governed aid in Palestine. And but it's true of Doctors Without Borders and a lot of these other orgs where they're having to suppress real information or just feed the world Hamas-approved propaganda. And Israel hasn't done itself any favors by the way it's failed to wage its side of this information war, but it's really been depressing to see how organizations that really were on everybody's short list of the most moral organizations on earth. I mean, again, organizations like the Red Cross or Save the Children or Doctors Without Borders or Amnesty International, all of these organizations have been corrupted in this process.
You know, I think sometimes, you know, I've heard you talk about this in the past and you made people uncomfortable when you've said that, you know, many of the innocent Palestinians aren't actually that innocent. And there's a recent poll, I don't know if you saw, reporting that 53% say Hamas did the right thing on October 7th, with 60% of Palestinians having overall satisfaction with their leadership. And if they held elections today, Hamas would win by a landslide.
Mm.
Have you seen that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's reasonable to be skeptical of opinion research conducted in a context like Gaza, right? I mean, obviously, imagine just being asked the question, do you support Hamas? And you're living in Gaza, where at any moment, members of Hamas can drag you into the street and murder you for having said the wrong thing. So it's understandable that some people would be skeptical of this, but there's other data, right? I mean, they ask people these questions in the West Bank, for instance, where Hamas doesn't rule things. It just, how much do you like Hamas and how much do you support what they did on October 7th? And you get, you know, similar levels of support, even greater support in the West Bank for Hamas than in Gaza. And it just speaks to the general picture, which has been quite clear for many decades now, of just how radicalized the Palestinians are religiously. I mean, just it is a fanatical religious culture that has been focused on a hatred for Jews and a hatred for Israel and a commitment to not accepting the existence of Israel to a degree that really you just can't deny or really even exaggerate, right? It's their point of view. I mean, the reason why there has not been a two-state solution is not that there was never enough people in Israel who would accept a two-state solution, but it's just the Palestinians never wanted to accept the existence of Israel in the first place. I mean, that was, there was an asymmetry there. So yeah, I mean, this is a problem of de-radicalization that has to be surmounted. And how to do that is anyone's guess, but clearly the boundary between Hamas and the rest of Palestinian culture is not as clear as most people would hope.
Okay, let's get to the lightning round, where we ask you, as always, to try to get through this as quickly as possible. A lot of questions. What are the 5 books you think everyone should read before they die?
Oh, that's impossible to answer.
Just throw me a handful, just quickly. How about one book? One in there, one of the 5.
Well, one fun book, an old book, but gets at the issue of irrationality that I revisit a lot. It's just a very fun read. It's Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay. That's just a very, very fun read. So I can recommend that to everybody.
Nothing else? That's it?
Well, there are, I mean, it depends on the topic. There are many topics that I often, in philosophy, I often recommend Derek Parfit's Reasons and Persons as an actual masterpiece. So there's that.
Maybe do a Substack and put your top 5 or 10 out currently.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite of your books?
I guess the one that probably captures the most of what I think and care about is probably Waking Up. I mean, I tend to kind of manage to get most of my concerns into most of my books. So you sort of do get my worldview in all of them. But I think probably Waking Up is probably the most important one.
Okay, next question. I know one day my young kids will ask about death and what happens after life, and I want to be honest with them without giving them a panic attack. Did you have those conversations with your daughters, and how did you navigate the hard truths?
It's a good question. You know, it's been a long time since I've had a conversation about that with either daughter. So I honestly can't remember where it landed, how old they were the last time we talked about it. I mean, no one close to us has died recently. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's coming, but no, I really don't have a good answer for that.
But when you were younger, you don't recall when they would say, "Daddy, are you going to die? Mommy, are you going to die?" What was your response to that? Do you not recall?
I mean, I would just be saying what my response would be to that. I'm not actually remembering an occasion where we had that conversation. I mean, I know I've said something like, "We simply don't know," right? And yet, I think I've said something about if it really is the end of experience. On some level, that's not a problem, right? It's not a problem that you weren't here before you were born. It won't be a problem that you weren't here after you die, really. I mean, you're not mourning the absence you experienced before birth, right? And you're not going to, and if it really is zero, you're not going to experience it. So it's not, and you go to sleep every night and, you know, yearn for this cancellation of experience. So we're not actually afraid of losing experience. That's not a fear.
I know, but Sam,
I'm talking to my five-year-old.
I'm trying to figure out what to say to my 5-year-old. I think this person, I relate to that.
Well, the thing I don't say is that if you don't believe the right thing, you're going to be in fire for eternity. I don't give them that.
I know, but you obviously wouldn't say, "Look, how did you feel before you were in existence?" So what I try to tell my kids now is, "Hey, you know, we don't even have to worry about it. I just punt it until they're older." And
well,
I
your
just
kids
say,
are younger. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm talking about what 7. I would say to my kids now.
Well, I think this person asking is saying my kids are very young and what, you know, and they're going to ask me at some point. So I assume his kids are 2 and 3 and 4 and he's wanting to know what happens. You know, what should he say? Obviously you said, okay, I'm not going to say, well, I'll see you in heaven one day. You're not going to say that.
I mean, there's obviously not a great answer, but my honest answer is we don't know, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you can be comfortable saying you don't know. That discomfort is something to get over, right? And to help your kids get over. We don't need cognitive closure, certainly not a false cognitive closure with everything.
Again, I just try to tell them, if it's any value, I just delay it. I say, yeah, that's going to happen, but you're going to be way much older. You'll be my age when that happens.
Yeah, so that's easy. But that's easy. Yeah, if they're asking you, are you going to die? Well, then, yeah, everyone dies, but it's something you don't have to worry about. It's going to take a long time. It's going to be a long time from now. I mean, you know, assuming you're comfortable with that. But the question of what happens after you die, you know, where is grandma now? That's a different question. And I think it's okay to just say, again, it depends how old the kid is, but to not know when you don't know is fine.
And that's good. Okay, next question. Is there a reason that the podcast lately seems to exclusively focus on politics and AI? Can we get some more episodes with hardcore science and philosophy?
Yeah, well, some of that's going to come eventually, I'm sure. I'm trying to think who's on the calendar. I mean, politics is just it's been unavoidable because it just seems like it's so, the need is so pressing to try to keep up with what's happening. And to, I mean, I'm just struck by how divided our culture is in its perception of the present moment. I just can't believe that half of our society not only doesn't think anything out of the ordinary is happening, they think basically everything that's happening is good, right? I mean, it's just, you know, we're living in a country now where masked men who will not identify themselves steal peaceful people off the sidewalk and disappear them, right? I mean, that's not a country any of us have ever lived in. And we're somehow acting like this is normal. And that's just one of literally 100 things that could be mentioned that are not normal. So I think, yeah, we're in a moment where, despite the fact that this bore is some part of the audience, we have to keep keeping track of the ground that has been lost and the things that seem to be looming on the horizon.
Well, AI is unprecedented too, but also just to say that the audience will often ask for something that the data does not back up. And these episodes, the More From Sams, this series does very well. And so does a lot of the episodes. So there's a lot of the episodes when you're talking about topical events. So people do tune in for those. And I think what the audience means here, if I can interpret it, is that they just want a balance of that. They just want to make sure that while we continue to hear from you and your guests on topical events that are consequential and pressing, they want to make sure that they don't lose their favorite single subject matter expert deep dives into you.
Yeah.
So we'll make sure we keep some of those coming.
Well, I mean, that's where my actual interest is. So that's definitely going to come. We'll get a break in the clouds politically. I will fill it with philosophy or science or something like that, no doubt.
All right, last question. Do you have any blind spots that you've discovered?
Well, I do think that I don't think this is unique to me, but I'm susceptible to not recognizing how problematic a person or their view is or their effects on the world are because I have a pleasant social connection to them. I mean, this is something that I've been roundly criticized for too. I mean, many people think I just have terrible judgments of character because there are certain people who I've had as allies or colleagues or have promoted or been on podcasts with or had on my podcast or called my friends or they called me their friends or what, you know, people who I've been associated with who are just fucking awful influences on our culture now. And I admit that, and it's a problem, right? And honestly, I still don't know how to navigate it, right? Because when you have dinner with somebody, presumably even, you know, Heinrich Himmler can seem like a nice guy, right? I mean, it's like there's a corrupting aspect to just being social with another human being. I mean, some people are charismatic and apparently sane, and then they go off and do the insane and unconscionable thing, or say the insane and unconscionable thing, or just have undergo some kind of evolution in their view of the world, wherein they migrate into some other orbit, which if, you know, if this person were a stranger, I would be, you know, destroying them at podcast length. But because they were, quote, a friend or an associate or a friend of a friend or whatever the relation is, I feel some kind of ethical imperative to bend over backwards to give them the benefit of the doubt or to not say anything or to not say it as much as I might. And it's definitely corrupting, but honestly, I just don't know that I understand the ethics of it. I mean, I think I don't know what I was just on the Trigonometry podcast. I don't know if that's aired yet, but I mean, I'll be interested to see what actually came out of my mouth, but if memory serves, I ran down Joe Rogan pretty fully in that interview, just being honest about what I thought about his effect on our culture. It's not been all bad, but the bad parts have been truly terrible. And, you know, he certainly was a friend, and, you know, we've been out of contact for some time, and I've tried to reach out to him privately, and he hasn't responded. But I felt the need to say things about him publicly that I'm very uncomfortable saying about a friend, but I just think it's unignorable at this point, right? So, but again, I don't know that I have the ethics right. I'm not at all comfortable with the situation I have found myself in, and I don't know how to get comfortable with it. The tipping point for me is when the consequences out in the world seem big enough, and I recognize that the only reason why I'm holding my tongue is because I've had some pleasant association with this person. It just seems irresponsible at that point to privilege the personal and private over the public imperative of making sense. So that's way, the way I've kind of split the baby. But again, I don't know that I have it right. And, you know, I'm sure that Joe or any other person that I've criticized might just think that I have done something unethical in sounding off publicly about them. Maybe that I betrayed a friendship on some level. And I would understand that view. But I, you know, and if I ever get their views wrong, or, I mean, obviously that's something to apologize for and to be very scrupulous about. And I'm that way even with my enemies. But yeah, I just think it's a, it's been a blind spot to be slow to realize the liability here, right? I mean, like, you know, like someone like Dave Rubin, you know, I was getting his hate mail for years before I acknowledged the validity of it, right? Because he was a friend. But once the weakness of his ethical compass became obvious, you know, the friendship unraveled, but it took so long. I mean, then I look back on all the criticism I got for being Dave Rubin's friend, and I have to admit, the critics were right. I mean, all that hate mail was right about Dave Rubin. And so, you know, I don't know what to do with that, but it is a kind of, I mean, it's a professional liability or it's a personal blind spot, I don't know. But it's, I'm a work in progress on this, and I don't quite know how to navigate it, but I do find that I'm just kind of breaking up with people now. There are people who play this very differently. I mean, the person whose hate mail I also get, though I still love him, is Douglas Murray, right? But he navigates this very differently, you know. And he, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit. I mean, he really just doesn't close the door with anyone. He's very tolerant of kind of a looseness of fit with other people's ethics in a way that I'm not. And I, you know, honestly, I don't know who's right about this. You know, it's a long life, and you don't know who you're going to have to be fighting in a trench with should the landscape change in the future. I'm prepared to admit that I could be totally wrong about this, but whenever I see someone's ethics go sufficiently haywire, I decide, all right, this actually has to affect the relationship, right? And that's happened with a bunch of people at this point. The boundary between the personal and the professional, all that's hard to figure out how to navigate, I must say. Again, I'm not confident that I have the right view of it currently. So,
all right. Well, this feels like a good place to end this episode. So thanks again to everyone who submitted topics and comments. If you'd like to help with this show in the future, you can head over to Sam's page on Substack and submit questions and participate in the online community. That's it for this episode. We'll see you next time.